With the state's primary election rapidly approaching, the Democratic candidates for governor attempt to galvanize voters.
We beat Phil Scott once, and we have to do it again, folks, because, look, if you can't afford to live in Vermont, it is time for a new approach.
I think in this moment, many of us are feeling scared and uncertain about the future. And so we look to leaders not just for answers, but for permission to believe that change is possible.
Plus, what new poll numbers tell us about how those races are shaping up, and a look at how short-term rentals are regulated in Vermont. All that and more ahead on Vermont This Week.
From the Vermont Public Studio in Winooski, this is Vermont This Week. Made possible in part by the Lintelak Foundation and Milne Travel. Here's moderator Mitch Wertlieb.
Hi, I'm Mitch Wertlieb. It's Friday, July 24th. And with us on the panel today, we have Mark Johnson from WCAX, Sean Robinson from VT Digger, and Aaron Calvin from 7 Days. I want to thank you all so much for being here. We're going to dig into some politics on the show today for much of it, and that is because we have a primary fast approaching August 11th, the primary for the Democratic candidates for governor, for lieutenant governor. Really interesting, you know, as we all know at this table, Governor Phil Scott has been enjoying high popularity. He has been a multi-term governor in Vermont. We'll get into some of the numbers that show a little bit of a slip there, but let's talk first, Sean Robinson, about these candidates for governor. Allie Richards, who a lot of folks know from the Let's Grow Kids campaign, and a relative newcomer, Amanda Janoux, are sort of duking it out here to see who will take on Governor Scott. What is the challenge for these candidates as you see it right now?
Well, I think the challenge is part of what you just said at the top there, which is how long Governor Phil Scott has been in office and how much support he's built up over the decade that he's had the job. We know that Phil Scott has long enjoyed a lot of support from Democrats, just like from Republicans, and he's won by ever-increasing margins. The last few times he's run for re-election, he's won every city and town in the state in 2022 and 2024. So the challenge is, you know, how do Democrats rally around a candidate who can appeal, you know, not just to the left wing of the party, but to the entire party and to Democrats who have supported this moderate governor for a long time, too.
And Mark Johnson, another challenge they have is how to differentiate themselves from each other. Allie Richards, Amanda Janoux, I know you've spoken with both of these candidates. How are they trying to differentiate themselves for Democratic primary voters?
Well, and I would go back and add one thing to what Sean said. I think one of their biggest challenges is getting known. I mean, we inside baseball here may know who Allie Richards is. Amanda Janoux is kind of a newcomer. But, you know, as we'll talk about in the poll numbers, the number of people that don't know them is enormous. So that, I think, is probably the biggest challenge there. You know, this is a really interesting dynamic that's going on. And I think it's sort of a microcosm what's going on here in Vermont with Amanda Janoux and Allie Richards of what's going on nationally. You know, we've seen Bernie Sanders and AOC going out. We've seen Mondami in New York. You know, I think the Democratic Party is trying to figure out where they're going to go. You know, are they going to go with the progressives? Are they going to stay sort of more in the middle? Even the Graham Plantner race in Maine is a dynamic there, you know, setting aside the problems that he ran into that made him drop out. But, you know, he defeated or is on the verge of defeating, you know, a longtime centrist governor in Maine. So I think what's going on here, and I think it's pretty well encapsulated with these two candidates, Amanda Janoux is clearly appealing to the more progressive side of the party. And you've got Allie Richards, who's trying to, you know, navigate that channel where she keeps the progressives interested in her, but doesn't go too far so that when she gets into the general election, that she hasn't, you know, taken positions that she's then got to walk back. You know, I listened to the debate that that you folks had here in Vermont Public yesterday, and you know, it was very interesting when they were talking about taxes to fund the universal primary health care that Amanda Janoux wants to do. Mm-hmm. You know, that Allie Richards was like, I'm not so sure about this. And I thought that was a really smart political move on her part to say, I'm not ready to commit to that. It would be very easy to do that in a primary. But if she wins, you know, then she'd have to live with the consequences of having said that.
So you brought up the Vermont public debate. I want to play a bit of tape from that. And this is the Democratic candidates you were just discussing, Mark, talking about their differences on housing. Let's take a listen.
I think the reality is that we need to take a multi-pronged approach to housing right now. One is we really need to limit private equity and large corporate ownership of the housing stock. We need to increase taxation on second homes, luxury estates, Airbnbs, et cetera, to actually reduce the property tax burden for residential Vermonters and to invest more in permanent affordable housing, like housing trusts, co-ops, and providing more support for first-time home buyers, first-time home builders, and for working families to renovate their own homes.
I think it is incumbent on the governor to explain why this is the top priority. So I have a kitchen sink approach to housing. Everything we've got, make it easier to build and cheaper to build and buy and rent. A sales tax holiday on building materials, templates for local zoning changes, technical assistance at the right place at the right time, including with funding to allow folks to use all the programs we have, like the CHIP model and VHIP, all these wonderful things that allow folks to build, and absolutely a second home tax to put that revenue in and change behavior to keep our investment in our housing.
Okay, for those of you listening on the radio, that second voice, the one we just heard, was Ali Richards. The first voice we heard was Amanda Janu. Sean Robinson, you know, I'm wondering, in listening to those clips there, are you hearing anything, you know, radically different in their approaches to housing? Is there a way they can differentiate themselves for voters on this issue?
Well, I think to what Mark was just saying, you heard Ali reference a couple of specific, you know, like state programs. Like you heard Chit mention that's something that came out of the State House. It's, you know, a program she'd be familiar with from the time that she's spent in the lobbying circles there. Yeah. I think at the top of Amanda's remarks, you heard her talk, you know, about things that you might hear from Bernie Sanders, right? Talking about these big, bold, progressive ideas, talking about this big systemic change. So I do think it sounded a little bit different. And the way they talked about taxation, like Mark said, has been different as well.
I want to show a graphic now. If these two candidates were going up against Governor Phil Scott in the general election, and you can see there that if Scott was going up against Ali Richards, he would at this point have a 43% margin. Again, these are estimates, over 35% for Ali Richards, 44% to 33% for Amanda Janu. Mark Johnson, are those numbers at all surprising to you? Do you see anything in there that looks curious?
Well, I mean, they're pretty close to one another. I think really, I just got to believe that Phil Scott would much rather run against Amanda Janu. Hmm. I think he could really differentiate himself from her much more easily. You know, Ali Richards has got this program, that the child care program that she was able to get through. You know, that's a huge deal for her if she were to run against Phil Scott. And so, you know, I'm not totally surprised by those numbers, but as we'll get to, you know, the governor's popularity is certainly not what it used to be, though. You know, we talked about this so many times in this program. When you're in the 60% as a multi-term governor, I mean, that's just incredible, because time is usually not in your favor. So, but I guess I would say, if I were Phil Scott, I'd be watching those numbers and thinking, which of these two would I rather run against? And I think he would rather run against somebody who's more progressive.
Very interesting. Let's take a look at some other numbers on this graph here. And there's something very curious at the top here. These are decisions that voters either approve or disapprove of when it comes to Governor Phil Scott. You can look there right at the top. It says that 16% of those polled approve of his handling of education. But then it says handling of education is a disapproval level of 20%. I don't know how to make sense of those numbers. Sean Robinson, do you?
Well, I mean, I guess I would note that this is showing that more people are disapproving of his handling of education than who are approving. And we know that the governor was, you know, all in on the idea of forcing school consolidation for most of the legislative session. Mm-hmm. He and his administration ultimately changed course at the end when they realized that it was not going to be politically popular. Both of the Democratic women who we're talking about have been very clear that they also oppose forced consolidation as an education policy. I think it shows that the governor has maybe lost some credibility on the education issue, but still really closely divided.
Well, I would add to that, that I think that it's not really well defined. I mean, I would say that the approval that he gets on education is that, you know, people are really upset about high property taxes. Mm-hmm. And I think they are happy to see him addressing the issue of taxation and what it's costing all of us to live here in Vermont. And then I think that, so that's, he's focusing on the cost of education, and people are approving of that. But I think this whole mandatory consolidation is the source of that, as Sean said. And that, you know, I think he read the tea leaves even before the University of New Hampshire did, which is why he basically bailed on it at the end of the session. So I don't think that's a surprise. But, you know, when people look at these polls, it, you know, it's not really fleshed out the way maybe it should be.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes the nitty gritty information you're talking about, the details are not evident when they put these out. I also think it speaks to just how confusing and complex education is as an issue that the governor can have, you know, a high approval here. Go ahead, Aaron.
Well, I mean, I think Governor Scott sort of put himself in this situation. He broke the Democratic supermajority in this biennium. And he had more support in the House and the Senate. And at the end of the day, you know, even people who aren't following the news very closely might look around and say, are things better? Is, you know, my property taxes better? Is the cost of healthcare better? It's not. So who's to blame? The person in charge.
Mm. It's going to be very interesting as we get to the general. Of course, we'll be discussing these things again. Let's talk about the Democratic candidates for lieutenant governor now. One name, again, if you follow these sorts of things, will be familiar. Molly Gray is running. Again, she's had the job before. Ryan McLaren is challenging. And Esther Charleston, who actually ran for governor in the last election cycle, is now running for lieutenant governor. Again, are we coming down here, Sean Robinson, to name recognition? Is this what these candidates have going for them? What can those who don't have the kind of recognition that Molly Gray has do?
Yeah, I think we are coming down to name recognition. I also think in this race, there's a lot of overlap in the policies that each of these three folks, you know, that they support. They're pretty similar policy-wise. I would say I think the differences that I've seen have been in the way they talk about their past experience that they'd bring to the job. Molly Gray obviously has been the lieutenant governor before. She's worked kind of directly pushing back against some of the Trump administration's changes to immigration and asylum policy since she left office. Ryan McLaren has talked a lot about his tenure working as a top aide to U.S. Senator Peter Welch. So again, on the front lines, kind of on the federal government level, he's talked a lot about his work supporting like federal funding for different infrastructure projects around the state. Folks might be familiar with the earmark process or congressionally directed spending. So like a new dental clinic that would be, you know, funded by the federal appropriations bill. So he's talked about that. And then Esther Charleston, you know, she talks a lot about her experience as an educational consultant. She says she's brought people together to have really hard conversations. And she also, as you mentioned, has that experience running a statewide campaign, albeit not a successful one. She lost handily to the governor, but she did, you know, get out there around the state and has a lot of experience talking to folks.
It's interesting you mentioned policy because, as we all know, there isn't a whole lot for the lieutenant governor to actually do in that job. And it's an important job. You're working with the governor. And to that point, here's what the candidates for lieutenant governor had to say about working with the governor. Let's play a clip.
What I think is unique about this moment is that we see the Trump administration coming for the state often on all sorts of fronts, from voting rights to attacking our new neighbors to taking our health insurance. And I'm uniquely placed as a human rights lawyer, an advocate, former assistant attorney general, someone who's been working with our new neighbors, refugees, for the last 3 years in a very close and deep way, to be able to be a point of reference, a point of expertise for the governor, and figuring out how the office can be used to help protect the fundamental rights of every single Vermonter every single day.
I have spent 10 years of my life working for Senator Welch and trying to serve Vermonters. That means working directly with the state of Vermont. The governor has been the governor that entire time, and we have worked closely on things like flood recovery, on things like immigration reform, on things like getting our veterans VA coverage for cancers caused by their service overseas. Like, all of those things are not partisan. Anyone that called our office, we weren't asking who you voted for, who you supported for governor. We were just trying to get things done. And I will do that with anyone who's in that office.
Once you're elected, especially statewide, you represent everybody. And so for me, I would walk in and make sure that I have an open door policy, that we're meeting, that we're in communication, that I amplify when constituents are communicating things with me that are an issue and that I don't agree with, but also highlighting what I do agree with. And that work is what I've been doing for the last 15 years.
Okay, that last voice we heard was Esther Charleston. Before that, we heard from Ryan McLaren, and the first voice we heard was Molly Gray. So, you know, I'm listening to that clip. They're saying, you know, this is why I would work well with a governor. Mark Johnson, is that something that you think Democratic voters want to hear from their lieutenant governor candidate, or do they really not really care if there's a close working relationship with the governor?
I mean, Phil Scott was a Republican lieutenant governor and worked perfectly well with Democratic governors. But, you know, I want to actually go back to the question you were asking, Sean. I mean, this is definitely all about name recognition. I actually thought the UNH poll a month ago that had Ryan McLaren at 7%, I thought, you know, there must be a glitch in the poll, but he was only at 11% this next time around. And, you know, he's basically saying what his own problem is, which is that he's been working behind the scenes. You know, Molly Gray has been out there out front. I mean, you know, for better or for worse, she was well known not only for being the lieutenant governor, but running for Congress. And that was, you know, somewhat controversial. People felt that she was, you know, moving a little too quickly to try to get into Washington. But she's a name that everybody knows. What's actually more important in that poll is how all three of those candidates, even Ryan McLaren at 11%, Esther Charleston at, you know, not a whole lot more, they all would be John Rogers, who's the incumbent. And I mean, that there's a, if I'm John Rogers, I'm looking at that poll going, oh my gosh, I am in deep, serious trouble. And, you know, the fact of the matter is he looks like he's going to be a one-termer who really only won because he ran against a, you know, a deeply flawed candidate in David Zuckerman 2 years ago. So, I mean, I would feel pretty safe today to say, you know, Molly Gray is going to be the lieutenant governor again.
As a bold prediction from Mark Johnson, but I, you know, you seem to be backing it up there because the numbers are, you're right, are not looking great right now for John Rogers. Let's take a look at, we have another graphic about from this poll, why people are supporting their preferred candidates. And if you take a look at the Democratic governor, most people say, I'm looking at the policies more than past experience or politics or ideology. For lieutenant governor, it's past experience. Yeah. So again, Molly Gray would seem to have a leg up there. And as we take a look, we should mention, you know, the race for the U.S. House. Of course, Becca Ballant is a very popular incumbent at this point. She's facing two challengers for the Republican. They will vie each other for the Republican primary in Gerald Malloy and Mark Kirster. You know, and folks care about politics or ideology when it comes to those GOP U.S. House races. You know, policies here, Sean Robinson, anything surprise you about that as far as what people are looking for from their potential Democratic governor candidate?
From their governor candidate?
Yeah.
I think Mark talked about property taxes before. I think you could argue that our last couple elections in Vermont have been about property taxes and the cost of living. Affordability is the buzzword nationally. Phil Scott has, you know, spent a lot of his political capital saying, like, I'm the guy who, you know, is fighting, you know, against new taxes, against new fees to make Vermont more affordable. The line I've heard from the Democratic Party, particularly this year going into the primary, has been, well, it's been 10 years of Phil Scott and Vermont is not any less affordable. And in fact, they say it's more unaffordable. Now, the governor, to that point, when we've asked him at his press conferences, says, okay, well, you know, there's been a Democratic majority in the legislature. You control the purse strings. So, you know, they're going to go back and forth at each other over that. But I think that this question of, you know, who really has the, like, not just the plan, but also like the willingness to tackle this affordability challenge is going to be important.
Well, that's interesting. Go ahead, Mark.
Let's not forget about the, you know, 800-pound elephant in the room, which is Donald Trump. I mean, people who are Democrats are very upset in this country. So when you're looking at candidates, even if they're running for governor, even though Phil Scott has not been deeply aligned with Donald Trump, I mean, people are you know, the crowds that show up for Bernie and AOC, you know, the election in Mondami. I mean, people who are Democrats are hungry for change. And you've got Amanda Janoux, who has kind of come out of nowhere, but has got presence. She's talking big ideas. The other thing is that, you know, all of these candidates are really talking about, if you were to poll Vermonters, what the, you know, three big issues are that they want. You know, it's taxes, it's health care, you know, and education reform. So, you know, I think they're wisely talking about those right issues. But, you know, there's a lot of backlash here to what's going on nationally, I would argue.
Yeah, and we've seen that, too, when it comes to immigration, the ICE raid back in March. There are so many issues that folks right in here in Vermont are looking at on a much larger scale. I'll also note very quickly before we move on from this that, again, we mentioned at the top, you know, Governor Phil Scott is still enjoying some high polling ratings here in the state of Vermont, but it has dipped a little bit. And I think, Sean, to your point, you know, you were saying that, you know, he was very popular in talking about that supermajority that Democrats had, but that's gone now. There's not a supermajority anymore. He can't keep leaning on that. And the questions about affordability in Vermont and all those things are going to keep cropping up, I think, more as we head to the general. Housing is such a big issue. It's one of the things that is a huge problem in the state of Vermont. Aaron Calvin, you wrote a fascinating piece with Hannah Bassett in 7 Days about regulating short-term rentals in Vermont, which didn't immediately seem to me like a huge problem, but you looked at communities in Stowe, Burlington, Woodstock, and Ludlow. Let's talk first about Stowe, where folks are concerned about short-term rentals, even to the point where now they're putting caps on that. Is that right?
Yeah, on Wednesday evening, their select board unanimously passed this change to their short-term rental ordinance, capping the number of short-term rentals in Stowe at 850. Right now, because there was a sort of a panic rush to get ahead of this cap, people who don't really even have any intention of using their properties as short-term rentals rushed to register their properties. That swelled the short-term rental registry to about 1,600.
Why are they doing that? Are they just, even if they're not intending to rent out their property?
Well, many of them, you know, might be second homeowners. They might not be on the ground. So they're taking advice from their real estate agents who are telling them, if you want to preserve the ability to do this, you got to get in on this now.
Wow.
But that's exactly the concern that, you know, certain people who rent their homes out in Stowe to be able to afford the high property taxes and high costs of living in Stowe, where the median home value is $1 million, you know, say that they rely on that to do this, and no one's going to stop them from continuing to do this, but they can't sell their home now and say, you can use it to generate short-term rental profit, because they can't guarantee that.
Now, the other argument that's being made about capping these properties is that there are folks who work in Stowe, they're, you know, it's a resort community. The folks who work in those hotels and the restaurants, they can't really afford to live there in many cases, right?
Yeah, this is an issue that Stowe has been wrestling with since the pandemic, you know, kind of brought this surge in home buying, and Airbnb, you know, has allowed people to turn what might have been residential homes into, you know, vehicles for profit. And it's, you know, it's sort of shutting out people who, you know, might be able to live and work in Stowe, who might not have as much means as most of the people who live in Stowe. And it, you know, has led to a lot of issues with, you know, being able to, for employers being able to find people to work. Like, you know, the high profile example of this is, a Skinny Pancake closed their location in Stowe last fall. Yeah. The owner, Benji Adler, cited the fact that, you know, it was just impossible for him to maintain a reliable workforce.
Now, it's a little bit different in a place like Burlington, right, where there's already a pretty low incidence of people using these sort of second homes for renting out and things like that.
Right. I think the issue in Burlington is that even though the number of short-term rentals constitutes less than 2% of the housing stock, you know, that's still meaningful in a town like, in a city like Burlington, where, you know, the cost of living is so high.
Yeah.
And the housing demand is there's so much housing demand and such little supply, that, you know, that the leadership at the time felt that they needed to take these measures to institute a strict residency requirement. And in order to do that, and also saw an opportunity to bolster their affordable housing in the city by adding new taxes to it. Now, you know, short-term rental owners, at least one that I talked to, said he uses his short-term rental to subsidize the long-term rentals that he's running, and, you know, sort of bemoans the fact that Burlington, which is, you know, trying to make up for lost Canadian tourism and stuff like that, isn't trying to, you know, allow short-term rentals to bolster their tourism economy more. But, you know, as we're only just seeing the housing supply in Chittenden County is starting to thaw a little bit, you know, it's still quite pressing, you know, to keep units available for long-term renters.
Yeah.
But so how is somebody who is not allowed to use it as an Airbnb in Stowe, they're going to have to rent that. I mean, presumably the idea is that then somebody could rent that home. But they're going to have to charge so much for rent in order to cover what the property taxes are. I mean, it seems like the real problem is that, you know, the cost of real estate, the cost of a home, I mean, it's just exploded. So I'm not really sure how that would help.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The short-term rental debate has gotten a lot of attention because, you know, for one thing, there is the Vermont Short-Term Rental Alliance, which is the local short-term rental industry lobby, and Airbnb have both gotten involved on the ground in Stowe to try to push back on these proposed regulations to no real effect. But they've been effective at generating a lot of controversy around it. But really, it's just one aspect of this broader plan that Stowe is trying to implement to, you know, designate affordable housing and build more affordable housing in the town and sort of try to set aside, you know, on purpose, a set of their housing stock that could reasonably be afforded by a hospitality industry worker or somebody who's, you know, even like, you know, a housing needs assessment in Stowe published last year found that even high paid professionals like lawyers have a hard time affording real estate in Stowe. So, you know, they're taking a page out of Burlington's book. They, at town meeting day, they passed, or they approved a new housing revitalization fund that, you know, would put more money towards affordable housing.
And Aaron, I'm sorry, yeah, we're going to have to leave it there, but I urge you to read that article in 7 days. It's comprehensive on the housing crunch. We'll have to leave it there this week. Our panelists, Mark Johnson from WCAX, Sean Robinson from VT Digger, and Aaron Calvin from 7 Days. Thank you so much for being here. I'm Mitch Wertley. See you next week for Vermont This Week.